Prison Colony Resistance is brought to you by Sam and the Maxman Productions. Welcome back to Prison Colony Resistance. We have another special treat, another leader of the resistance here in the prison colony, a key leader who is in parliament, has joined us today. You probably know who it is, but no spoilers for now. Sam, are you excited for our guest today?
Oh, mate, I'm very excited. Look, we got this guy in by pure badgerman. I call it the Shawshank method. If you're unfamiliar with Shawshank Redemption, the movie, it's when Andy tries to start a library. He writes a letter every week asking for books, and they say, here are the books, just stop, no more letters. And he turns around and he says, right, two more letters. So this is how we have our next guest. And look, I'm not ashamed to say it, but it worked.
This is how you make change in government. You just pester them with letters and you get parliamentarians on our show. Without further ado, the senator for South Australia, Alex Antic. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Thanks, guys. And it's true, Sam just wouldn't back down.
He is persistent.
Yeah, I am persistent, absolutely. It's
no, it's one of my best genuinely things. Great to be here. And I have to say, I mean, I've been saying this a bit probably to the annoyance of the mainstream media, but I love talking to people that, you know, are doing something different in the world of broadcasting, whatever it is. You know, independent media is the way of the future of all types, by the way, like, you know, that's, you know, Substacks and podcasts, the whole lot. So I'm really, no, it's an absolute pleasure and happy to help.
I agree, Senator. I think I consistently and almost without fail am disappointed by the mass media. And I've tried. I listen to different podcasts. For example, I listen to The Daily by The New York Times. Have you heard that podcast?
No, look, that doesn't sound like something I'd listen to a lot, but
good.
You know, like I listen to, you know, I listen to far left media as well. I turn on the ABC occasionally. They'll hate that. But, you know, that's the look. And you have to. And that's part of the problem, I think, is that we've, you know, in many ways, I think you need this style of broadcasting because people are now, they've retreated to their corners, haven't they? And we've all got to find a middle ground and tell the truth. And that's why I think what you guys are doing is really great.
And the like research and facts and, you know, all the data coming out is suppressed so mightily. Yeah. Like that New York Times podcast I heard was talking about the rise, it's the steepest rise in infections in the States, which is in Rhode Island, and they are off the charts and they are vaccinated to the extreme. I think 90% is vaccinated in the state. So I was listening to this podcast and they kept saying 50% of the cases coming in are double vaccinated. This is the New York Times, the newspaper of record. So this is history happening in the moment. And I said, that's pretty weird because that doesn't correlate with any of the data that I've heard. So I started researching and slowly but surely I discovered that you get injected and you're not vaccinated until 14 days later.
Right. Yeah,
and we know that a lot of the cases in the hospitals are adverse events from these shots. So that kind of, and I see that again and again and again. So it's very interesting to have you on the show, Alex, because the media has really tried to do a number on you.
Yeah, look, it's seemingly so. And in fact, just as I come on today, I was just, you know, jumped on the computer and got onto the emails and had a bit of a look and saw that YouTube, and this is my first one, by the way, so I'm quite proud, but YouTube have censored one of my videos. So, you know, thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's a great moment. It was inevitable. It was actually the one I spoke to Steve Bannon on War Room about, you know, all sorts. And they're really, I mean, I don't think there was anything particularly controversial in there, but apparently it's violated their you know, terms and conditions. So that's my first one. So I break that news here first on Prison Colony resistance.
Fantastic. There you go. Breaking news from the senator.
Breaking news. I know that'll get you jumping over the fence to hear that. But no, look, it's true. I think and I think in my case, if you do break from the narrative a little bit, you immediately become a bit of a target, which you expect. The press, particularly the mainstream press, are looking for, the next kind of, I don't know, madcap freedom fighting lunatic. And, I don't know, I'm here to defend myself, but I think anything far, far from it, to be honest, in being, kind of off with the pixies. I think this is just normal question asking and answering that we need more of out of politics than we certainly need more out of the media. An independent, strong investigative media is really, when you think about it, the foundation stone, the cornerstone of politics and good government, because politicians need to be able to get their story out, and if the community needs to be able to get the story out, and if the journalists are not doing it, and they're not asking the right questions. In fact, most of the press conferences we get with health officers all around the country are just sort of, question and stat releasing, aren't they? They're almost media releases, and no one ever drills into the sort of statistics that you've drilled into there. That's just why I keep asking questions publicly of the chief health officer here, Nicola Spurrier. You tell us that whatever the figure is, 80% of people who enter into ICU are vaccinated. But what does that mean? What do you actually mean? And do they have any other comorbidities? And what does vaccinated mean? And these are the sort of questions that journalists need to be asking, and the large part are not asking, except for people like yourselves.
So why aren't they asking? Is it, a lack of direction from their bosses to say, right, go out, do your thing, think for yourselves, or are they getting pushed from above saying, right, we're only going to be talking these points?
It's a really good, it's a really good question. And I mean, you sort of go down the rabbit hole if you go too much. And I don't know, I tend to think it's partly cultural now with these sorts of outfits, in the sense that the days of having the time to be investigative, I think, are probably evaporating a little bit. We've never seen more competition in the media, the mainstream media space. So I think the days of having, like we used to here, two newspapers, one in the morning and one in the evening, and a fair bit of space in between, with the ability to go off and ring people and check sources and dig down into it and ask questions about these stats, I think are probably probably over, because now you're competing on Twitter with other outlets. Even in a sort of relatively small to medium city like Adelaide, there are people trying to break the story, people trying to break the story at national level, and you just got to get it out there. So I think it's a bit of both, but I don't know. I do wonder, I keep getting told by various media outlets, oh, there's no editorial guidelines, we're not pushing a particular line. Well, you could have fooled me. I open some of these newspapers and I look at it and I think, this is all a bit samey. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is, but it's not helpful. But what it does do is it provides an opportunity for people to do different things. We've seen that, of course, with Joe Rogan, haven't we, who's built this enormous audience simply because he is pretty down the line. I mean, the left want to say he's a, he's a right wing, standard bearer, and the right want to say he's too soft. And the truth is, he's, I think, just pretty investigative, and he's interesting, and he asks the right questions, and he has good guests. And guess what? People are tuning in. So, the market will decide. Yeah.
It used to be like we used to have these long, hour-long segments on television for interviews with important politicians and scientists. Right. And you had like, not debates, but discussions. And it wasn't about shouting each other down. Recently, we've seen that the news cycle has gone to a week, probably down to like a day now, about 24-hour cycle. And then you add to that all the social medias, which basically you only click on a video if it's 1 minute or 2 minutes, anything over that, if you're venturing into a video that's 10 minutes long, you've kind of gone overboard.
That's right.
And the other thing that I wanted to mention was the editing. You mentioned that you were on The War Room with Steve Bannon. I saw that interview. You sounded very sensible, logical, explaining what happened, how they changed. That.
You must be in the minority then.
Probably. I'm in the 10% of Australians who haven't drank the Kool-Aid. Yeah. But Steve Bannon just let you kind of, tell your story and about how the change of rules between state border closures. Then I clicked on a video that popped up after that said, you might be interested in this. And it was from, I think it was Nine News and the senator, da, da, da. And when I clicked on that, as soon as you went to kind of explain your position, I think you said, I've been put into a quarantine hotel, and then it was a hard cut. And then it's just them talking about what happened, but not letting you tell your own story and then putting their own spin on it.
Right. Right. Yeah. And look, and that's to be expected. I mean, that's as old as the hills when it comes to the media, isn't it? I mean, you expect to be, because, you know, I mean, sensationalism sells. We all know that. It's no big deal. But I think you're right what you say about the old style of news media. We see it in the US with some of these talk show hosts now that are basically propagandists and just telling a different story. And the ones that are sort of succeeding now, as we've said, are the Joe Rogans, who are just going back to doing what people wanted, which is just entertainment. They want to hear what people have got to say. And I didn't catch a lot of him, because I'm probably, even strangely, a bit too young, although that's pushing it a bit as well. Parkinson, who used to do these sorts of shows, and he would just do that. He would listen to the answers and he would ask the questions, and then he'd just let the guest tell their story. And you know, I think people are missing that. And look, I think politicians are to blame as well. Politicians have become extraordinarily risk averse. I think under most circumstances, the ability to get a politician to just sit there and, you know, speak his or her mind is drying up a bit. I think people are worried about saying the wrong thing because of that editing you talk about. You know, it's like that old episode of The Simpsons where Homer gets into trouble for harassment, you know, of the babysitter, but they've just completely edited it, to sort of make it look like he was a bad guy, and politicians are scared of that as well now, which is a real shame, because the days of having, you know, politicians just kind of talk through issues and speak a little bit outside party lines, and we have to be able to do that. I don't make any bones about that. There are some things I'm just not going to agree with, and that's okay. I'm part of the team and happy to be it, and happy to promote the team, and obviously we'll always, you know, do that. But sometimes we don't agree, and I think if you say it any other way, then you're just not telling the truth.
But that's how the world works, you know. If we were all in agreement on absolutely everything, it's completely boring and it doesn't serve anyone's purpose.
That's right.
We don't get genuine ideas and genuine discussions. So, there's no point in keeping quiet. And if you do disagree with something, especially these days, well, damn it, don't worry about offending anyone. Just come out and say it.
That's right.
We're only here once, and I'm certainly not going to die wondering, what if I had have said this, or what if I had have done that? No, that time is done.
That's right. And anything else really does cave into the mob, doesn't it? Because I mean, there's so much cancel culture doing what it does, and it's dangerous ground if it's not about, we all know that freedom of speech is not absolute. You can't just go out and criminally defame someone or incite violence or whatever. We all get that. But the ability to catch people out on one word when they didn't really mean that exactly, or twist or try to recreate history like we see today. I mean, see today that somebody apparently has poured red paint over James Cook's statue in Victoria, I think. So, you know, that sort of rewriting of history, cancel culture, changing the names of everything, and it's affecting politics as well, which means it's affecting the discussion, it's affecting the debate, and the debate is good for us. That's what makes a democracy work.
They are so afraid of a counter narrative of people asking questions. An example of that is when I was living in Sydney, I live very close to Newtown, and they put up a mural, and it was Scott Morrison in a Hawaiian shirt, and there was flames underneath the shirt. I went to see the mural. Yep. It only lasted two and a half days before it was painted down. So they painted it over because they were afraid of the message that conveyed to the general public. Yeah. And that shocked me. A tiny little mural in Newtown, it becomes national news, and it has to be deleted right away.
Yeah.
Shocking.
Same painter had one here. And I mean, I have to say, on this instance, I wasn't keen on it. It depicted drug use and all this sort of stuff because, you know, the theory was all the coalition politicians smoking what appeared to be crack pipes, but they were coal pipes, you know, all this sort of thing. Now, it's cute and I get it, and artistic merit's all good, but that's an example, I think, of free speech drifting into the incitement area. So, but look, as a general rule, I think art has always been, partially about political commentary, hasn't it? The old statues of emperors were all really about making the emperor look like a good guy and a strong guy or whatever. So, art drifts into that, and you know, we need to be sympathetic to it on both sides. And that's what we've missed. I think we're not, I think social media probably has turbocharged it a bit, but everybody's retreated to their corners a little bit, haven't they? And we've all got to find a way to get back to talking about facts, because that's all anyone wants. And you know, the COVID debate highlights how dangerous it can be to censor facts.
So how do we actually get back to this point? How do we actually create a healthy environment where we can actually have discussions between two opposing parties.
Well, I think it's just about putting a bit of steel in the spine. I think politicians have got to get a bit of steel in the spine. They've got to start talking about things, weathering the limp lettuce leaf beating that you get from the mob, as a result of saying the things that are true, and not being afraid to do it, and branching out from the media narrative. Ultimately, politicians are driven by the media narrative, and I suppose the media narrative is driven by culture. They always say that politics is downstream from culture. And so, giving people a bit of courage, and again, at the risk of going back to Rogan again, I know we don't know what will happen, but there's all these calls to have Spotify remove him. Neil Young, I saw yesterday, he's called for, now who cares what Neil Young thinks? I mean, I don't think I've ever listened to a Neil Young song, and I don't think that's going to change, but that's not because, of his political messaging. It's just because, I just haven't. So, but standing up to that, and Spotify having the courage to sort of say, no, this guy, I mean, obviously it's because he rates and he's very good, lucrative, for them, but
they paid him a lot of money.
They pay him a lot of money, and they probably can't afford to break the contract or something like that. But also, there've been plenty of instances where companies have bailed out on people in those circumstances. And I just think, those that show that they will tell a different story, to tell a message that people are interested in, and have some courage to do that, slowly you break that down. I mean, this sort of mob mentality of canceling things just takes a few courageous humans, I think, and hopefully it gets infectious and it continues. But it's certainly not. I don't think it's rectified by everybody smiling and capitulating. It hasn't worked historically. Ask Neville Chamberlain.
Now, you mentioned a couple of words there, keywords: narrative, story. So we continue to talk about the narrative is fracturing, follow the narrative, counter narrative. So these elements of human psychology, the story that we believe to keep us safe and keep us alive, is a key instrumental part of how we formulate our decisions going forward. So my question to you, Senator, is, do the as a senator on the floor of parliament, you can look into the eyes of fellow politicians and see that these are the people making these decisions. Do they believe the narrative, or is it something else?
Look, that's really hard to answer. I think what you find, generally speaking, is people up. I mean, I think most of the members of the Labor Party ultimately believe in, their political narrative, and I think those of the Greens do as well, and those on the conservative side do as well. If you asked anyone on any one particular issue, I'm sure people vacillate a bit between issues or policy positions or whatever. One of the things I will say is, on the Liberal side, on the coalition side, we do have the ability to vary our views a little bit. People cross the floor. I mean, I did it for the COVID discrimination bill that One Nation put up. I crossed the floor and voted with One Nation in favour of trying to protect people from vaccine discrimination, and five of us did. So that's unheard of in the Labor Party, by the way. That just wouldn't happen. So you'd be out, kicked out. So look, I think on the whole they do. The problem is, once again, I think it begins and ends with the media narrative. I think, I think politicians are human beings, and they see what they read in the papers, and they're very driven by what they read in the papers, because people are driven by what's in the papers, and that drives polls. So regaining the, and this is the other thing. I mean, there's a whole different discussion about this, but I sometimes get a bit of criticism for being too interested in the culture wars, as they're called, too interested in whether or not Coon Cheese changed their name to Cheer, and, someone's getting stuck into Golden Gay time, and it always seems a bit trivial. But I just think it's critical, because I think the more we lose that cultural narrative to censorship, whatever it may be, then the more we lose politics as well. Everything, as I said, politics is downstream from culture. Culture drives the media narrative, and that drives politics. So I think, regaining some control over the sensible debate, and not just having people screaming in the background is so important. And I think that'll help to sharpen up politics, frankly.
True. And with that, it's also about resilience, because we've tried to inoculate anything that might be offensive to anyone, like a Coon Cheese, Golden Gay time. And Coon is the name of the town where the cheese was made.
The creator, Edward or William or Edward Coon or something. I mean, it's so ludicrous. It's not
unreal. Yeah, and that was an issue of the States. I mean, it's not really an issue here necessarily. Yeah. And that was the person's name. But yet somehow we've taken that in because we don't want to offend anyone. In doing so, we've made ourselves a bit weaker, I think, and not as resilient and very easy to offend.
Perfect. You took the words right out of my mouth. Weak. We are becoming a weaker nation because we're not standing up for, you know, these sorts of things that, you know, don't like the changes they're making, but what are we going to do? Let's just sit on our hands and do nothing.
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes people think they're trivial issues, and that's my point. Like, I think, you know, it may be that somebody thinks, well, what's the difference, you know? And look, there are so many examples of this that seemed like they probably just prior to COVID, they were very trendy and popular. We had Colonial Brewery, who they just picked the, I don't know why they'd picked the name in Perth, Colonial, and you know, some activist decided that he was going to get a bit of a run on it and made a media story out of it. I don't know what they did in the end. I don't think they changed the name of the beer, but they certainly copped it, you know. And you know, people working hard to, you know, to create jobs and to create a product shouldn't have to be dealing with that sort of stuff. They are almost, you know, universally, to use an old hackneyed frame, first world problems, aren't they? But they're important. They're really, really important. And you know, we have a habit, I think, sometimes of getting lost, you know, in these issues. And you know, I sometimes, this is probably, you know, very frank, but I sometimes think that doesn't matter what side of politics you're on, whether, you know, in our chamber, I look around and I see, you know, in the Senate, I see people from Labor and people from the Greens and people from One Nation, some independents on our side. And I think by and large, I think people all kind of want the same thing. It's just they've got a different way of getting there. And that's what we're missing at the moment. I think, you know, the more we find threats from outside, the more we have to realize, you know, and that sounds like a horrible hackneyed phrase, but it is true. And you see it in the US as well, there's so much division, and yet, you know, there's so much to be cheerful about, particularly on, you know, on a day like Australia Day, where, you know, we're a pretty good example of a country that's done things pretty well. You know, I think we are not a racist country, I don't believe. And, you know, I don't think we're an unfair, inequitable country, and I think things are pretty good. So, you know, we should try to find that common ground as much as we can, and, you know, picking on little things and then having the media beat them up. I mean, you know, it's not helpful. I think it'd be good to get back to a time when, you know, media would tell the story. It would be, in the issue of Coon cheese, it would be, you know, man says he's offended, rest of country can't be bothered with stupid story, you know, like that'd sort of be the truth. Well, that'd be the sort of thing you guys would say if you were asked about it, I'm sure. So
yeah, no, absolutely. It barely rated on
barely rates
radar.
A mention, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't. And you know, that's media and media pushing what they want to do and getting people wound up over nothing.
And it works, but it works because he got the result. The minority voice worked there. So that's the trick. And, you know, again, getting back to the same thing, the risk of pumping your tires, and I'm not, you know, I'm sure you're happy with it. I'm not here
Why
to
not?
Do that specifically.
Keep pumping until we blow up.
You know, it's important. Like people telling, building an audience, telling a story that's outside the scope, because you'll find people will drift towards these sorts of podcasts, I think, increasingly. Because they're interested in hearing, you know, hearing another view, hearing another side of the story, and someone who's prepared to ask questions without fear or favor. It's really important.
Sam and Alex, I have an urgent text from the Prime Minister of Australia, Scott Morrison, and he's saying prison colony is an offensive term, so we now have to change the name of our podcast, Sam. We are now Detention Center Country Resistance.
Well, how about Medi-Hotel?
Medi-Hotel Country Resistance.
That's the one. Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, I know. I always love that. I always get in trouble for calling quarantine camps or detention facilities or whatever, because, of course, there's no similarity between a fenced off camp with huts that you can't get out of in a detention facility. There's no similarity with that at all, of course. So, you know,
and one of the reasons we started this podcast, Alex, is because we see people like, and I've mentioned them in several shows, Brett Weinstein, Heather Hein. They've had a couple of interviews with Australians who have not been granted an exemption despite showing that that particular person was very has severe reactions, anaphylactic shock, to any of the adjuvants in the vaccines, the quote-unquote vaccines. So they were wondering what was happening inside of Australia, because they're looking at it from the outside in. So we have a prison, we do have a prison, but we have a media bubble that shields any sort of inquiry from the outside. So being inside the prison colony, we thought we could detail day to day, for the record, for the historical record, what is happening. One of the reasons we really want to have you on is because we've heard stories about these Medi hotels. Can you give us the details? What was it like? What was the food like? What were the staff like? Were you treated rudely, nicely?
No, I got, well, two things about that. The staff were really good, really good. And food was really good too, actually, I got to say. So that's two things you can say about it. And that's always the criticism is, well, what do you mean? This is not detention. The food was nice and the staff were nice. Like, yeah, but I couldn't leave. So that's pretty detained as far as I'm concerned, you know. But look, no, it's not a good experience, I got to say. And the overall, you know, the look of it and the feel of it is wrong in many ways, I think. I mean, I just, you know, I, you know, you're taken there in a van, for example. So the background story is that I knew it was coming because I was told before I left that, you know, that I, that after having the, I won't bore you with the details, but wrangle with the authorities, to get an exemption to come home full stop. And then ultimately I was told, Roy, okay, you're cleared, but you've got to go into a Medi hotel for 14 days. So I knew it was coming. So I went to the plane, the airport, knowing that, and got on the plane knowing that, I should say. And I also knew the press would be there waiting because I'd got a call from a journalist something like 10 minutes after I'd been told by SA Health that information. So that's pretty curious. Anyway, getting off there, you know, I said to the guy at the gate, look, you know, apparently I've got to go into a Medi hotel. Who do I speak to? And they looked around oh, I'll come here. And oh, you speak to this policeman. Of course, they're the photos that we used. You know, it looks like you're being detained. Well, you know, you sort of are, but I also had to find these people, and presumably, you know, they would have found me anyway, but whatever. So
you could have worn a mustache and gotten out of there scot-free.
Yeah, that would have been good. That would have been a great look. Yeah, no. So look, you know what's coming, and look, we're all, you know, we're complying with the direction, whatever. I didn't like it, but you know, I've got to do it. So there was no issue. The policewoman was lovely, and you know, we just had a little chat as we were walking along. So that's not the image that the news media wanted. So they waited until other cops were there for the head, you know, all that sort of stuff. So that's all fine, whatever. Anyway, you're transported there in a van, and basically it's a pretty uneasy feel, I got to say. You know, it's sort of, the people are nice, but everyone's masked up like it's, you know, whatever that movie with Ebola was, you know. You know, I kind of think of it anyway.
Outbreak.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. Yeah, it's like that, right? And you go straight into your room, and then basically it's 14 days where, you know, you're in a room. It's a nice room, but you know, food's brought three times a day. They knock on the door. You can't get it immediately because of COVID. You know, like some reason, you know, science. Even though you're wearing a mask, the science. You know, we're all about the science. Except, and then you can't get it too late. So there's literally, you know, like a sort of a 3 to 10 minute window to pick up your food from outside your door, which is weird, but whatever, you know. They, and people, you know, family obviously bring things in, but you know, there are limits on, not that I was going to sit there and drink 17 bottles of wine, but they'll only let you have one a day, even though someone will drop off, you know, like a couple of bottles just for the 2 weeks or whatever. So, you know, all this sort of stuff. So it does have this feeling of being detained. And you know, I'd get phone calls 3 times a day, and people are very nice, but you know, how are you feeling? Are you all good? And I'd say, well, I'm great, but I'd be better if I'd go home, but there was never going to be any of that. People turning up to do COVID tests. So it does feel like you are in prison. It's as simple as that. And yeah, I get it. It's not Mobilong or Yatla or whatever, but ultimately if you're denied liberty, you can't get out, then you are being detained against your will. And, I think Aussies, we're putting up with that 2 years ago. I just would love to see the medical science that suggests that that's appropriate. And in fact, I've FOI'd it, and I'm told now actually SA Health have agreed to release it. So we'll see. We'll find out what the reason for mask mandates. And, you know, I'm sure there's lots of detailed medical evidence and science behind it all. I'm sure there would have to be for people to go to these lengths, wouldn't there? You know, for recommendations to be made to mandate people out of their jobs, you would have to have some pretty solid science behind you, I would say. So I'm looking forward to seeing it. Yeah. I just, you know, I'm looking forward to working out why it is after 6 negative PCR tests I was such a threat to the world. So
will you release all this, Alex?
Yeah. I mean, if there's anything to release, I'll release. I believe. Fantastic. I'm entitled to. I don't think there's any issue with that. And We'll see what they, I mean, I'm sure there's a whole lot of redacted stuff and whatever, but ultimately, you know, we're told that this is all being done on very, what's the phrase that's used? Very strong science. There's a phrase that I now can't think of, or, you know, whatever it is. So we're going to see. We're going to find out.
Now,
we're going to find out.
When you were in that Medi Hotel, did you ever think of, you know, calling up housekeeping and asking for, you know, a whole bunch of bed sheets, tying them together, throwing them over the balcony and just, you know, scaling down?
My athletic performance would suggest that would have been a bad idea, even if I'd been given abseiling gear. So I never really occurred to me, to be frank. But I actually did get calls. You know, that was one of the three calls a day. I sort of touched on the first one, how are you feeling, which is fine. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, people need to be checked up on. So I joke about that, but I don't mean to. But the next one was, you know, with the police just checking you're still there. And I was like...
Where am I going? I
mean, like literally, if I would open the door, this is the other thing. If I would open the door to check if the food had been delivered, I'd get a call saying, don't do that because the CCTV camera had seen it. And I would say, what? And they'd say, no, you can't do that. You can't open your door. And I'd say, oh, okay. Well, why is that? You know, because, you know, of COVID science or something. I don't know. Anyway, I'm not having a go at the cops. But but the other one I'd get during the day was just to make sure you're still there. And that one really amused me because... You know, there were only the one or two bed sheets, and that'd get me. I was on the ninth floor. That'd get me to about the sixth, I reckon. So all I would have ended up doing was frightening somebody on the sixth floor.
Oh, my goodness.
It didn't happen.
I did see a press conference yesterday with Premier Marshall. Sorry, I should be respectful of our premier. Yes. And he was saying the reason South Australia has the best economy in Australia at the moment is because they followed the science and they followed the advice of our chief health officer, Professor Nicola Spurrier, who said, don't touch a ball if it comes to you. Make sure and stagger the enrollment of students for 2 weeks, even though they're going to end up in the same place 2 weeks later. Right. How does that work?
Don't spend Christmas with anyone that's not vaccinated.
Yeah. Well, we've asked her about that one. She hasn't responded yet. But
that's a surprise.
So if this release of information through the Freedom of Information request, if that does show that the science wasn't necessarily followed, what are the next step, Alex? What can we do? How can we use that information to make us more free?
Well, I think we've got to put the cart before the horse. I always get that around the wrong way. That is right. It's the cart before the horse. You don't put the cart before the horse. So look, and I don't know. I don't want to preempt what will be in there, but I think it'll be interesting to see this because they're so prescriptive, these directions. And that's the thing that I'm puzzled by is, you know, if you're making decisions about people's futures and their jobs and their businesses, you know, I mean, businesses have been put through the ringer here and, you know, all at the behest of SA Health bureaucrats, then you would hope that there was detailed medical advice, which said that, you know, while you're sitting down, you can take your mask off. And while you're walking through the premises, you should leave it on. And you would think, some infectious diseases specialist presumably has recommended that. That would be the only reason why I could think why you would be so prescriptive in a public health direction. So, look, I don't know. I mean, perhaps that's being a bit facetious and perhaps there, well, perhaps, yeah, that's me being facetious about being facetious. But there may be good reasons for this and, you know, like we should never, ever prejudge, of course. But look, if there's not, then, you know, I think we do have to ask questions about why it is and on what basis are we simply putting people to what is, I mean, they are burdens. They're burdens for businesses. There's no doubt about it. They're burdens for people that have said, you know, I want to make decisions about my own medical autonomy. That's a position that's hard to see anyone arguing with 3 years ago. And yet here we are, you know, you almost can't understand how anybody could argue with that if you'd gone back 3 years, nobody knew anything about COVID, and you were told that about, any sort of treatment that you might have. How do you not get a choice in all of that? Of course, the answer here is always it's an emergency. And also the misinformation that's peddled by the mass media about transmission. I think that's the big one, which the media really have let the Australian people down on, is the reluctance and inability to push against that narrative that somehow you're protecting other people by, you know, taking these injections yourself. And of course, there are lots of arguments. There's the argument about transmission, which we know is a nonsense. And then there's the argument about public health, and that seems to be falling apart as well. So, you know, there might be some explaining to be done in retrospect. And I can tell you, I don't intend to let it go. I imagine there's going to be a lot of walking back in a number of months. I saw a great tweet the other day, which said that I can't remember who it was, someone in the United States who said there almost certainly won't be a single Democrat who was pro-mandate by the 2024 election.
They'll clean up their tweets, they're like, yeah, editorialized.
We're going to see a lot of reinvention of history, but let's, you know, and I think that's why what you guys are doing is really important. In order to get better, we have to remember.
Thank you, Alex. We try to, you know, we try to see through this madness, this clown world that's being erected around us, and try to understand, why is this clown world being erected? Yeah. Who's building it? And we've issued a couple of conflict of interest coins for people who are key to this new infrastructure that we find ourselves in. And another thing is, as you mentioned, the science, like, we see that Australia is one of the most vaccinated countries on earth, right? We're going into the booster, we're going into that third shot. I believe Premier Marshmallow said 50% of South Australians have rocked up and flexed up and done their bid and done their part and gotten the booster. But the transmissions continue. Our cases are skyrocketing.
Yeah.
I mentioned this to a friend of mine who was first in line because, you know, he had some serious reactions to the flu. And I said, but mate, aren't you worried about this transmit? It doesn't block transmission. It doesn't kill the virus. And it allows mutations and variations. And I was telling him this way early in 2021.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he said, no, mate, it's like a seatbelt. And so here's a little meme. Why comparing the vaccine to a seatbelt is key. And if I may, Senator, I'll share the screen with you so you can see the joke as well. Yeah. So the joke is, comparing the vaccine to a seatbelt is great, because here's why it's a great comparison. Number one, you need at least 3 seatbelts to be fully belted, plus a new seatbelt every 6 months.
Yeah, yeah.
Number two, your seatbelt doesn't work if the car next to you doesn't have one. And number three, without proof of a seatbelt card, you might lose your job and be excluded from normal everyday life.
Yeah, it just sums it up, doesn't it? It's a good way. Look, and this is why meme-style politics has become so effective, is because it tells the story all in one easy-to-digest sort of, you know, analogy, doesn't it? So good. And they're the questions that should be being asked. Yeah, literally, they're the sort of questions which are not being asked by the mainstream media. When you open newspapers or you get onto your nightly news, all you get is death figures, you know, and you never get a comparison. Well, what are they normally at this time of year? And, you know, what else is involved? And, you know, these people that have died tragically, what else are they carrying? What are they got? Other comorbidities? All these questions, they're all very simple. And, you know, it's not difficult stuff. So if it's not difficult, why is it not being done? That's a question I can't answer, but it's certainly something that I think is pretty important. And, you know, and of course, I mean, in, you know, it's such a massive topic, we could go on for hours. But the next question is, well, once we've seeded ground on truth here, like, what's next? So how long before we're, you know, there's another emergency? Because emergencies seem to be very effective in getting people to cash in what they used to hold dear. We've seen that here. The sorts of things, as we said, that people just wouldn't even dream about giving up 5 years ago, we've given up here, and it's because it's an emergency, right? So, you know, that what will be the next emergency is my question, and how will we deal with it, and can we wind back and grab these liberties back? I sort of, from a very early point on in South Australia, and I mean, we know that this a lot of these powers have just been gifted off to the bureaucracy through the amendments to the Emergency Management Act. What's important is going to be reclaiming as many of those as we can, because there are a lot of consequential amendments all the way through that have also, you know, things that we wouldn't even think about that, you know, we may never see again in terms of liberty and freedom. Like, I don't want to be in a position where, you know, we're being monitored like this in future. And I don't think, and, you know, the Adelaide Advertiser gave me a real work over for having the temerity to suggest that the sort of QR code world we're in now might give way to, and the home quarantine app, which, you know, I don't know if it's got much of a use. I didn't get to use it, but I probably would have.
The Wellbeing SA program, is that the one you're talking about?
Which one? Sorry, the home.
The Wellbeing SA program, that was.
Yeah, right. Yesterday. That's whatever it's called. The one where you go home to quarantine, you show your face to the phone call when it comes through, and it checks your GPS location, all that sort of stuff. that, you know, the temerity to suggest that that is a very slippery slope and the thin end of the wedge, and how long before we're seeing the sort of things that China are seeing, you know. Yeah. I mean, I don't want it. That's not Australia, and not the Australia we want on Australia Day or any other day of the week. So, you know, we have to be very careful with this, and we have to find a way to wind it all back.
This is one of the main reasons why I decided to start speaking out, is because I have a 21-month-old. He's a beautiful little boy. He is just everything, but I do not want his life connected to an app. Yep. And you can see where this is going.
Yeah.
And you really can. And progress and technology, the way it develops, it's a scary prospect.
It really is. I mean, you see it in China now, and, you know, we all get laughed at for even having the, you know, gumption to suggest it, but this is a reality in China. If your social credit drops because you're jaywalking, then you don't get a chance to buy a train ticket, or, you know, you can't find a mortgage, or so that social credit style approach is really worrying. And I think it's you don't have to draw a very long bow to see it evolving, even if it's slowly.
Pervasive center, yeah. Because you, like you said, this technology that you're mentioning is inside of your house. It's in your phone. Right. So they send you a text, I believe, and you have to take a picture of yourself.
Yep.
And send it off within 5 minutes to 10 minutes. Something I believe, like you have that. A very yeah. small window of time. Yeah. And then they coordinate that photo that you just sent with the GPS yep. location to ensure that you're at home quarantining and not infecting the people with a common cold. Sorry, with Omicron, the Omicron. Also, as we've seen in China, you can jaywalk, you know, you cannot cross at a proper crossing point and jaywalk, what we call in the States jaywalking, and just cross in the middle of the road, and you're safe. There's no cars coming. But if a camera catches mm-hmm. you doing that, within a minute to 2 minutes, you get a text from the Communist Party government saying your social credit score shall be deducted for not following the proper rules.
Right.
On that note, we know, we've seen in CityMag, I believe, we've seen news reports that Adelaide is becoming a smart camera, smart technology city. Have you heard about that, Alex?
Yeah, I have. Actually, for my sins, I spent 4 years on the Adelaide City Council, for which I'm, as I keep saying, I'm still receiving therapy. I joke, I am not receiving therapy, but I should be from that experience. Look, it was, you know, it's so easy to see those things being trumpeted as a virtue. And I know that we've seen that from SA Health here. That, well, isn't this great? We're world leaders in this, you know, liberty denying dystopian app that we've created. Well, you know, there's always a danger in, you know, assuming that technology is going to fix our problems and doesn't have an ulterior purpose. And I don't know if it does or it doesn't, but certainly if you've got cameras up all around a city, then the opportunity exists, the infrastructure exists then to, even if it's only slowly and incrementally, you know, to chip away at some of these freedoms. And of course, the counter argument to that is always, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, it's not a problem. But, you know, we know that's a nonsense, because who decides what's wrong and what's right? And that depends on who's in power and who's in government. So that is a fundamental tenet of having government less involved in our lives, as far as I'm concerned. I fundamentally believe that I want government out of my life as much as I can. I don't want them tracking me. I don't want them knowing everything about me. And that's not because I'm doing anything wrong. It's just because I don't think government can be trusted with my data, frankly, and we've seen that. So, you know, that's no criticism of any one particular government. That's just a general principle. So, I don't know. I don't know what the City of Adelaide is doing in that space now, but I know there are a lot of cameras around. Most of them, I think, are controlled by SAPOL. And in fact, in some cases, they're very important. I mean, we had some incidents down in Hutt Street when I was on council there, which needed surveillance. And I think they did some good work there to clean up the area. But, you know, as a general rule, I you know, if I'm going to jaywalk, then, you know, just let me jaywalk. You know,
you could easily see someone coughing and then getting a sign, exactly. A citation, a text, you should be isolating.
Yeah. And that's the other thing with the home quarantine app. Apparently you need a sign on your door as well, you know, saying this person is quarantining. So I don't know if they still do that, but certainly the original version of it was meant to have that kind of, you know, kind of warning sign on the front. And I mean, it's just, you know, if this stuff isn't making people alarmed, then and I think it would be making people alarmed, once again, to come back to the initial story, if the journalists were doing their job. You know, and there are some, I should say. I mean, I don't want to blanket throw them. I mean, there are many that are good. There's a guy who writes, who I don't know at all, I've never met, and I think he's in Washington, but Adam Crichton from The Australian, who's been writing some great stuff about COVID, you know, and I would think it would be very middle of the road. I couldn't tell you what his politics was, whether he was, I mean, you would say if he's writing for The Australian, he's probably, but who knows his personal politics. But it's very factual. And he was from the get-go 2 years ago, he was saying, well, hang on, we just, you know, like, let's just think about, you know, let's just, and that's what you want out of journalism, I think. And, you know, I just don't think we're getting that across the board anymore. We're getting too many press releases.
So, you know, we talk about the slippery slope into the social credit system, and you know, that as frightening as that is, we saw Scott Morrison address the World Economic Forum over the weekend, and now I don't know how many people actually saw this. I wouldn't have thought it would make mainstream media, but some interesting things that he did touch on was digital identity,
right,
and the transformational opportunity of critical technology. So there is definitely a push towards what you were talking about, and it's going to take a lot of people with a lot of backbone to actually stand up and say, hey, you're going about this, you haven't actually conferred with us, you know, you're making these decisions on your own, we don't want any part of it.
And it's not just SCOMO, like you said, it's a World Economic Forum, because I did see an EU session where I don't remember who exactly, but one of the speakers in the EU committee was saying we need to create a data repository, we need to create EU identity so that any transaction that you do goes through your identity. So we know exactly what you buy, we know exactly what you do, where you go, how you travel, what bus pass you buy, where you live, and all of that is kept safe.
Yes, very safe. Like that QR data that got distributed, or, you know, lost in New South Wales a few months back, or whatever it was. Yeah, look, I mean, I just don't know. I need to, and look, there is some digital ID legislation coming before the parliament in the next period as well, which I need to study in great detail, because I have some reservations about some of that myself, I have to say. So
watch this,
Senator. Space, yeah. On the war room, you said something that I found quite like, I hadn't heard that expression, but you said, let's drain the billabong. How do we drain the billabong?
Well, look, I think, you know, I mean, we're talking about, you know, it's a sort of a generic term. We're talking about taking power back from bureaucrats. And that requires political will. And I think one of the things that I've seen increasingly in politics, and I mean, I've been involved in some capacity for a decade or more, but, you know, that's party politics. But one of the things that I've seen that is a bit alarming for me is this increased political class. And, you know, there is a, you know, I don't believe politics was ever meant to be a career as such. I think it was always the you know, you'd get arguments about this, but I think at its best, it was always something that people did for a short period of time to give something back, to bring hopefully something to the party, you know, some expertise in one area, and also to listen to people and to deliver their message to parliament. I mean, it's pretty rubbery, but that's sort of basically what it is.
That's the George Washington, John Adams view of politicians.
Yeah.
Do it for your country. And
things have moved on. So, okay, you need politics is a difficult thing to be involved in if you're not across the rules and you're not, okay, so all of that. But it used to be that from my side of politics, we would laugh at the Labor Party because they were political operatives. You know, they went from a trade union into a minister's office or a member's office, then straight into a parliament, and they'd do that for three terms, and then they'd be, you know, so that's your whole career, just politics, basically. But increasingly, that's all sides of politics now. You know, the Liberal Party has the same thing. We have people that join the Young Liberal movement, they then go and work for a politician, they then go into politics, and that's all they know. And the difficulty with that is that you end up with, I think, people that are risk averse. If you don't have something to fall back on, you're not going to speak your mind. You know, you need to have had a career outside politics in order to make sure that you've got somewhere to land when you're done. And that's hard. Getting people out of careers into politics is really, really difficult because of the scrutiny and the this and the that. You know, it takes a sort of a rare type of sadist to get themselves into politics, which, you know, might explain my own personal, you know, problems. I joke, but anyway, we're allowed to still have a sense of humor in this world, aren't we?
Is that your therapy, Alex? Lash yourself on the back.
Yeah, exactly right. That's my therapy. So, but you know, we do have to find that way so that we're not, you know, and this is part of the problem with the United States, I think, is people just become political animals and that's all they do. So working the political game from a very young age, getting into politics, never rocking the boat, and then just keeping the status quo, that's part of our problem. So when I say that, I mean, not only dealing with career bureaucrats that are just, you know, doing the same thing over and over, but it also means getting people who have a previous life into politics. And that frankly means people have to join political parties. You don't get, you know, and I mean, I would say, you know, if you share values, you know, of liberalism and, you know, whatever, then the Liberal Party is a good position for you. I'm not here to spruik that, but we it's, you know, like if you're not involved in the machine of politics and selecting candidates who you think share your values and, you know, who are going to take those values to Parliament for an election, then really you're just shouting from the sidelines. And, you know, if you're involved in politics on a party level, then you do get the opportunity to frame policy and to, you know, to pick candidates and to be more involved. And, you know, I think that's where the game is. And I know that's happening a lot in the United States, but I think that needs to happen in Australia as well. And we need to give politics back to people. There are lots of good people in politics, I should say. And once again, a bit like journalists, I'm not trying to pick on every single person, but I think there needs to be competition in politics like there needs to be in the market. And people need to know that, you know, at their next pre-selection or if they want to go for pre-selection for a party, that they've got good competition from the local business owner who's decided he wants to just take a couple of terms of hiatus from his business and get into politics and give something back, or, you know, finding a way to make it achievable for, I don't know, an ophthalmologist to say, right, well, I just want to take a bit of time out from this and do this and give something back. And because I know there are lots of people who would do that, but
a sacked healthcare worker.
Yeah. Well, exactly. But that's the point, right? Like until people have a reason other than simply they want to, you know, we've got to make the environment right for people and give them the support as well. You know, it's one thing to have a great, I mean, I've seen many, many really excellent candidates in politics not get through simply because, you know, the numbers didn't fall their way. And we have to get the best and brightest and the people that are most there to question and, you know, shake the narrative and do all the things we need to do. Otherwise, the democracy just doesn't function the way it needs to.
It's funny you say all this, Alex, because this is almost a carbon copy of the message that Monica Smith was telling us. We did another interview. She was incarcerated in Victoria for 28 days. She refused to take the PCR test. All she was doing was telling people, go protest. And she said the same thing you're saying. Find a candidate, support them, push them into power, and then they can use the system to revise the system. And we see that a lot in the rallies. We go to these rallies and we talk to people. We talk to a person named Dave who's running for office because he's had a gutful. We talk to Phil Mueller, who's had a gutful. Sam, our own podcast co-host, is also running for politics. We don't know what party yet. It's a top secret. But my question, Alex, is, okay, all right, so I hear our listeners. So our listeners, go check out that Monica Smith interview. If you like the truth bombs that Alex is delivering, you're going to love the truth bombs at Monica. So right after this, go and listen to that. Go ahead and do all your, you know, just keep listening, keep downloading. But Senator, my question for you. My question for you, Senator. Okay. Our listeners are saying, you three, you think you know everything. You know, you got these conspiracy theories about this and about that. Okay, fine. Let's say, Alex, let's say that in March 2020, you get a call from Premier Marshmallow and he says, Alex, you're my man. Mm-hmm. Here is a committee on COVID-19. You have plenary powers. Do whatever you need to do to fix this. Mm-hmm. What would you have done, Alex? How would you have done this differently?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. And it's all very easy, isn't it, to sit back and say we have all the answers and we don't. Look, I don't know. I mean, I think one of the things I would have had is perhaps a bit more parliamentary oversight on some of these decisions. Of course, once again, these things are being done in real time. So, you know, at the time it was... it was an emergency, and I think at the time we were all very, you know, keen to get things in place to fix it, but I think we probably did need to structure something that didn't give as much power to the bureaucrats as we did, frankly, and I've been quite open about that over the 2 years. I think we have handed too much power to too few. It's, you know, I mean, that's just what happened, really. We've got effectively the police commissioner who's in charge of some very important and far-reaching powers now.
Is he out of quarantine now, or is he still quarantining?
I don't know, actually. I'm not sure. But you know, and that's to make no criticism of him or anyone else. It just, as a basic model, I think that's really, dangerous in a sense. So I would have been inclined to have you know, even if it were a committee structure so that things were getting funneled back through Parliament, these decisions. So the ultimate theory being you need to have people that are accountable to the public who are, you know, who are making the final call on this stuff. I think that's the real lesson out of all of this. And, you know, I mean, things are done on the run, and this is the danger with the emergency. As we said, the major emergency is people will do things quickly and fast and to get things done, probably most of the time for good, you know, out of good conscience and good reason. But the system's got to be robust. And, you know, I think we do need always to have people who are elected. It comes back to the issue of making sure that's what important of having people who take your values to Parliament as well, so that they're there. But if they're not getting a say in it, then they're not much good, and there's not much point in having Parliament. So I think that's probably my major observation. I would have preferred to have seen something that gave the elected body more say in the decisions that are affecting people, that are affecting the electorate, that are affecting businesses, that are affecting people that are subject to mandates.
Well said. Well said.
Well said. Yeah. Yeah. Keep the power. And we've seen that this is a carbon copy of what's happening in the States, where in the United States, the power has been given to the NIH and the NIAID under Fauci, and he can pretty much do anything he wants. And Walensky can say anything she wants. Here's Fauci, a lifetime bureaucrat who's never been elected, telling senators that they don't know what they're talking about to their face.
It's
unreal.
It's mad. And you know, I mean, this didn't get much of a run, unsurprisingly, but on a very basic level, I was always stunned by this just prior to Christmas break. It might have even been the end or the beginning of December. The last sitting week of Parliament was basically shut down here by SA Health. SA Health shut down the Parliament because of a COVID outbreak. Now, you know, to the general public, you might say, good, that's good. That's a public health issue. But just take a step back and think about what we're talking about here. We've got unelected bureaucrats, and I'm not suggesting there was any nefarious conduct there. I'm just saying, as a basic principle of law or, you know, governance, unelected bureaucrats took a step back and said, we are shutting down the elected body, the highest level of legislature in this state, because of something we have decided. Wow. Like that's mad. Like, you know, and it went through to the keeper, as we say in this country, went through to the keeper without a whisper. No one talked about it. You know, maybe you guys did, I'm sure.
But that happens. That happens frequently. These kind of decisions get made. They get made at odd times, and no one bats an eyelid.
Yeah.
No one either cares or, you know, oh, well, it doesn't affect me, you know, directly. So, you know, what's the big deal?
Yeah, that's right.
I'm fine with that, right? I'm fine with a a technocracy, where you put somebody who has very technical understanding of the situation, you put them in charge to get you through the hard yards, and then you give it back to the politicians. But we see that these technocrats, these chief health officers, they are making these decisions for us, and they're claiming that it's based on the science. But like you said, they don't show us the science. They don't let us ask questions about the science. And they just say, trust me. Just trust me.
Yeah.
You're locked at home. You can't do anything. You can't spend Christmas with your family. You can't travel. You got to get this poison injected in. Sorry, a vaccine injected into you. Go do this thing. And trust us. It's the science.
Yeah, well, let's talk, you know, health and healthcare system over Christmas. Private hospitals and public hospitals have said, hey, guess what? If you're a patient here, no visitors, regardless of your vaccination status, no day passes for Christmas. And can you imagine the burden that this is placing on the mental health of these patients going through some of the most, you know, traumatic times of their lives?
Yeah.
It makes absolutely zero sense. And the fact that now, you know, I'll talk from personal experience. As much as she doesn't want me to, my mother-in-law, towards the end of last year, has been diagnosed with lung cancer. It's lung cancer which has spread to her bones. So there is no remission. There's no nothing, right? Mm. It's just treating day to day. So. Getting slightly emotional.
Yeah.
Need a moment, Sam?
No, there's power on. We can do this. So
flex up, son.
So, you know, her conditions of entry, right, her last immunotherapy, right, she's in a wheelchair, she can't walk.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? If you want to come in and have your immunotherapy, you need to go and have a PCR test. So if someone that, is wheelchair bound can't sit in one position for any too long, for too much time. And at this point, we're seeing, wait times of 6 and 7 hours for a fucking PCR test that, I'm sorry, is inaccurate and completely misleading. To have someone who is on borrowed time made to wait for 6 to 7 hours in a car for a test, I'm sorry, but she does not get to spend her days like that. That is absolutely appalling.
And I think, I mean, that highlights the difficulties with a one size fits all approach in any event, doesn't it? I mean, it's
It
just
does.
it's absolutely it's absolutely tragic, and it's shocking news, and shocking for everyone. And I think there are so many of those stories. We our office gets, I don't know, five similar stories a day about people who can't get into see a newborn baby, or I mean, can't, there's got a dying relative and they can't, all of that sort of stuff. Once again, I think you could safely say that if people were shown, and not necessarily on a micro level, on an individual level, but just the science behind that policy making, and be comfortable that there was some merit in that, and be comfortable that that sacrifice she's making and your family is making is having some bearing on public health, then there might be more comfort in that. But as we've said, we're not getting it. No one's showing us that science. So of course it leads to frustration. Of course it leads to animosity. And I totally understand that. And look, I think, we're going to be looking back at some of these decisions over the coming years, and and really soul searching over some of them, I think, because there are so many tragic stories. And we have to look at the other side of it as well, all the mental health stuff that comes with people being locked in isolation, and some very serious side effects. And I saw there was some discussion, I saw a very short outtake of it from the World Economic Forum again, when Jacinda Ardern was talking about mental health and whatever yesterday. And you just have to wonder how much of this is,
Yeah, cringe. Real
But it's
cringe.
just, anyway, so
It's not
there's just
an
so
Atlanta
many different
Hills.
angles to
It's
it, and it's
not.
awful.
But guys, one
It's
size fits all is the way to go. It makes it easy. That's why I give Alzheimer's medication to my 6-year-old, obviously.
That's right.
Obviously.
Obviously.
Oh, man, yeah,
No, it's
you
mad.
just stun me sometimes where you go, seriously. I'm glad we're not censoring this, but
Well, it's a clown world. I think we've explored the clown world. And Alex, we really want to thank you for spending part of Australia Day with us. We know you're spending it away from your family and friends, and spending it with two guys that you don't know, and having a conversation about things that are causing you to maybe go to therapy. We really appreciate your time. Where can, obviously you're a senator, so you're easy to find on the parliament floor. We can come and see. Oh wait, we can't, right? Unless we're up. Anyways, but where can we find you on the socials and all the other media?
Well, I've actually, well, interestingly, now with the, I had a suspicion that the YouTube slash Facebook censors would get me. So I'm still on Facebook. I've got a Facebook page, which is Senator Alex Antic, and a couple of copycats in there as well. So floating around, I'm constantly trying to delete fake profiles, which is weird. No one's ever tried to imitate anything I've done before, so there must be some utility in that. But social media world's a weird one. But I've also just started a Getter account, so that's floating around out there as well, just as a backup. I think it's good. It's good to have a new platform. It's not going to be Twitter, that's for sure. So there is that. That's very early days though. We haven't really properly launched that. It's just trying to populate it with something interesting other than a photo at this stage. So we're just trying to do a bit of that. But that'll launch pretty soon. So at this stage, yeah, Facebook is the main one, and we're going to work on a bit of a Getter account as well.
And if our audience, if our listeners want to share their story with you, like you said, you get 5 to 6 stories a day, where can they email you?
Well, look, I mean, obviously there's a parliamentary email, which I mean, we're constantly trying to help people through issues like this. It's senator.antic@aph.gov.au. So our office can help with, things. I mean, the frustration is there are a lot of things that we just, don't have the oversight to fix, but there are some that we can, and we're here to help. So by all means, flick me an email if there's something you think we can help with, or something that you think needs attention. Can certainly try our best, and we have. So,
There it is. There's a senator, one of the leaders of the resistance, a lawyer for 20 years who said, you know what? I got to get in this game. I got to change the system, joins the city council, Has to go to therapy for that. Now joins the Senate. He keeps fighting on our side. Well, not on our side, on Australian side. You know, trying to free all of us, keep our freedoms and our democracy intact. And we really appreciate that, Alex. Any final message you want to share with our listeners? Any parting words?
No, I think thanks for having me once again. So important. It's just really important. I just increasingly now have very little interest. There are still some mainstream media outlets that I'll you know have a chat to occasionally, but on the whole, I just like to speak to people that get it, and you know, and that sort of, you know, are happy to talk about issues without fear or favor. And I think it's great to see you guys doing that. So keep it up, and I think people just need to keep the faith. I have a feeling that the message is starting to get across. We've just got to keep talking about it. We've got to keep, you know, encouraging other people to talk about it as well. I think the more, you know, what people you hear talking and questioning things in a very healthy way, in a very respectful, lawful way, and we've got to be, you know, we've got to do all of that. The more people get courage to think about things themselves. So just keep it up, keep talking, and you know, and we'll see this one through.
Great message. That's a great message for me as a host of a podcast. I love to talk. I can talk for hours and hours and days and days. How about you, Sam? Any message for our listeners?
You know what? I think we're good. I think we should end on that. That's perfect.
You sure you don't want to say anything particular, we'll for example?
We'll let that one slide today.
You sure you don't want to refuse? You don't want to resist?
I don't want to. I want to live free, and I do not want to comply.
There it is. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Alex. This has been the Vax Man. Keep an eye out for our next special interview and listen to the other special interviews that we have. They're all truth bombs, just like the type that Alex delivered today. We really want to thank the senator for his time. And thank you, listeners, for listening. And we'll see you for the next special interview.
This has been Prison Colony Resistance, where you come to get your PCR test for truth.